This is ESPN 103.7 Lafayette and 104.1 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
That's right. Can you dig it?
It's time for 2 hours of the best sports talk on the airwaves.
Can you dig it?
The Jordy Holtberg Show with your host, the Blonde Bomber himself.
Can you dig it?
Jordy Holtberg.
Good afternoon and welcome. Oh, so close and yet so far away. Bad habits reared their ugly head yet again for the New Orleans Pelicans down the stretch. LSU baseball finally wins a college baseball series. Yes, Cajuns lose 2 out of 3, but still control their own destiny. And the Saints knocking on the door of another draft. Do they stay pat? Do they move up? What do they do? All these stories and much, much more coming your way today on this Monday, April 22nd, the year of 2024. Hope you're having a great day so far. It's a beautiful, crisp, fall-like Chamber of Commerce day. But my main man, James Mesh, is hunkered down inside the EVCO Development Studios in the producer's chair. He's on the campus of Delta Media, where you'll find ESPN 103.7 Lafayette. Head west. We're on ESPN 104.1 in Lake Charles, streaming all over the world thanks to our free mobile app, ESPNSouthwestLouisiana.com. And the Mike's Marine Hotline, open and available at 337-706-0111. Mike's Marine, keeping you on the water. Well, where do we begin? Yesterday, Pelicans fall to the Oklahoma City Thunder, 94-92. They took control of inside the paint. They got on the offensive glass. They had 18 offensive rebounds that turned into 24 second chance points. Right where you want it. Their problem, as it often was during the regular season, late game execution. When it's time to step up and win, the Pelicans exit stage right. Pelicans shot 3 of 11 from the field, committed 4 turnovers in the final 5 minutes. It's one of those days, and you've got to be able to come up with clutch plays. That's what playoffs are all about. You can see how the officials now let more get away with more defensively. It becomes a rugged bump and grind slugfest. And to the Pelicans' chagrin, they couldn't get things done down the stretch. Unlike LSU gymnastics, you know, for years, decades, the notion of winning a national championship for LSU gymnastics was like out there, way out there. I remember when I was in school, they'd have gymnastics meet on the side of the Carl Maddox Fieldhouse. Then they would go into the Pete Maravich Assembly Center after that, and they would drop curtains down because no one was there. But then the sport grew, and you got to give DD Bro a lot of credit. She went out and beat the bushes and marketed and just did whatever she could. And they, all of a sudden, they're getting 10,000 people, 11,000 people, 12,000 people. And boy, they were knocking on the door, only to fall to Oklahoma year after year after year. But much like the LSU women's basketball team, who went to Dallas for last year's women's Final Four. And that year, shockingly, South Carolina got beat, opened the door for LSU. They took it all the way to the championship. This year, just like that, the always favored Oklahoma Sooners got bounced in the semifinals. And the Tigers now in the leader role to bring home the championship. They were the favorite. And it wasn't easy because they had to end the meat on the beam, the hardest apparatus you could ever think of. After one little slip up, everybody else was spectacular. And LSU gets it done. Whew. Got it done. National champions, just remarkable how they got it done. And Aaliyah Finnegan clinched the team title with a 9.95 on the beam. And don't look now, but just like LSU's women's basketball team, who lost a couple, LSU's going to have a whole bunch of people back with a great recruiting class, and this thing should keep on keeping on. But congratulations to Jay Clark. Tried to get Jay on today. He said, I would have loved to. I have some family commitments. I can't do it. We will get Jay Clark on tomorrow. We'll get DD Bro on tomorrow because she built that thing from the ground floor where it was nothing, built it to a high, high, high level. And Jay Clark and this squad knocked down the door and won a championship. Just remarkable. Just remarkable. So pretty darn good. LSU baseball, well, they figured out a way. They win on Friday with maybe the best game they've had of the season when they run-ruled Missouri. Took care of business, got great pitching, got great defense, just got it all done. Got it all done. Then Saturday, they fell by a 12-1 run rule win Friday. They rallied Saturday, but it was too late. They fell 8-7 to set up the rubber match on Sunday. And a streak that LSU hadn't experienced since 1977 was snapped as LSU claimed its first SEC series of the season and the first conference series win in the last six tries. And they win it by winning 6-2 Sunday behind just a Herculean effort by starting by the pitcher, the relief pitching of Griffin Herring. They had some timely hitting. Nate Atkinhausen got the start and was doing good. Got in a little trouble in the third, fell behind 2-0. Then Herring comes in through five scoreless innings, allowed one hit and one walk while striking out eight. That's what I call in the clutch. In the clutch. Yes, indeed. So there you go. All the home court teams won in the opening round of the NBA playoffs. So you know what the old cliche is? Playoff doesn't begin until you win as a visitor on someone's home court. Yes, that's the deal. So stay tuned for more on that. The NFL draft is coming up. Some tidbits. There have been running backs used to be popular. Now, last year, two running backs were drafted in round one. No running backs are expected to be selected on Thursday night. There have been three NFL drafts in 1968, 2004, and 2009, in which a record 19 offensive players were picked in round one. In the 2024 draft, with all the needs for a quarterback, with the depth at wide receiver and the offensive line, that record could be broken. If Caleb Williams is the number one overall pick by the Chicago Bears, USC's Lincoln Riley would become the first college head coach in the common draft era to produce three number one overall picks: Caleb Williams, Kyler Murray, and Baker Mayfield. Drake May's vying to be a top pick in this draft. North Carolina players are used to going number two overall. Former Tar Heel standouts Mitch Trubisky, Julius Peppers, and the greatest Lawrence Taylor each were the number two pick in his respective draft. Is Drake May going number two to Washington, or is Jaden Daniels going number two? We shall see. Marvin Harrison Jr. will become the fifth son of an NFL Hall of Fame player to be a first-round pick. The others, in 2014, Jake Matthews, the son of Bruce Matthews. In 2013, Kyle Long, the son of Howie Long. In 2008, Chris Long, the son of Howie Long. How about that for a family? And in 2004, Kellen Winslow II, the son of Kellen Winslow. How about them apples? Alabama offensive tackle J.C. Latham is expected to become the ninth offensive lineman under coach Nick Saban since 2008 to be a first-round pick. No other school has produced more than five. And if you like wingspan, how about this for a stat? Georgia offensive tackle Amarius Mims had the largest wingspan at this year's combine, 86¾ inches, only a quarter inch smaller than that of two-time NBA MVP Giannis Antetokounmpo. How about that? All right, our guest list today, each and every Monday, Anthony Renato, the former LSU All-American, joins us. We'll talk about LSU's winning an SEC series at Missouri. Ali Cassell will join us. We'll recap the Pelicans in their inability to close out games down the stretch. In hour number two, John Hendricks will give us his final thoughts on this NFL draft that begins on Thursday. What will the Saints do? And then Blake Ruffino will join us. How are the Tigers doing in the portal? One big-time prospect said no to the Tiger, one Tiger, and went with another Tiger. He said no to LSU and went yes to Auburn. So we'll discuss that and where does LSU stand with all of that. So, James Mesh, good afternoon, my friend. I hope you had a wonderful, wonderful weekend. Yeah, Pelicans, ouch. So what is our poll question of the day, sir?
This one deals with the Pelicans. So continue to talk about that one. Can they still win the series despite failing to steal game one against the Thunder last night? 41% have said yes, 36% have said no, but then there's 23% that have said only if Zion comes back and plays in the series.
Well, you can forget about that. He's not playing in this thing. I just can't imagine that because injuries tend to take longer. He's going to be evaluated 2 weeks. So how many games are being played in 2 weeks? And then how much time is it going to take him to get back into the rhythm and conditioning and all that? Because with a hamstring, you can't run. You can't do anything. So is he putting those 25 pounds back on? I hope not. I mean, I hope not. But, no, it's not going to be with Zion. Can they? Yes. Will they? No, they will not. Anyway, vote on X, X and on Facebook. What do they call it? Meta? X and Meta? I don't know. Crazy. Whatever. So here we go. 14 minutes after the hour, we'll take our first time out of the day. When we come back, LSU gets a big series win. There's still a long way back in these Belmont Stakes with a lot of ground to make up. Can they do it? We'll find out next.
You're listening to ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, your home for the best local sports talk in Southwest Louisiana.
All right, we are back on this Monday, April 22nd. So glad that you are with us. Hope you're enjoying this day, the beautiful weather, crisp and clear, and sun is out, and LSU wins a baseball series. So if you're an LSU baseball fan, you got to be feeling a little bit better about yourself. A 12-1 run rule win Friday. They rallied but fell short 8-7 on Saturday and then came out with some great bullpen work to win the finale and the series 6-2. Anthony Renato, who knows a thing or two about pitching and winning as a national championship pitcher for LSU, joins us each and every Monday during this college baseball season. I feel a lot smarter because of it. I hope you do as well because he's great at this. And Anthony, thank you for the time. We finally get to talk about something good. Amen.
Amen is right. The weather's beautiful. The Tigers won a series. Yeah, it seems like things are being right with the world. Yeah, it's nice. But yes, so thank you for the intro, Jordy. Always a pleasure to be here. And let's talk some Tiger baseball for sure.
All right. Well, let's jump start it. Pardon the pun, with left-hander Gage Jump, who was named the SEC Pitcher of the Week today after a 7-inning complete game where he allowed one run on 3 hits with 1 walk and a career high 14 strikeouts. You know, I questioned, why is Jump pitching on Friday and not Luke Holman? Well, shows how much I know.
Well, rightfully so. I think, you know, one, rightfully so, he was named SEC Pitcher of the Week. But I also, I'm still questioning it. I mean, and again, now, right, he shoved and he had a great outing and it worked out well for the Tigers. But we did see Luke Holman struggle a little bit on Saturday, you know, and for things that have been going kind of wrong all year, Luke Holman's been the solid right thing, you know. So, you know, I still question it a little bit. But, yeah, no, I mean, let's not take anything away from Gage Jump. The dude absolutely showed 14 strikeouts in 7 innings and a complete game win. You know, when you get all that run support, that's always fun. So definitely started off the weekend right. And like I said, so, you know, as much as we can question it, the Tigers won a series. So looks like it was the right move for sure.
You mentioned run support and how important that is. As a pitcher, when you get out there and the bats are clicking and you're getting these runs and it's 4-0, 5-0, does that change your approach as to how you pitch? You don't have to be as finite maybe as if it was a 0-0 score?
100%. I think it's a completely different mindset. And especially, you know, I think about it from Gage Jump's perspective. When you're facing, you know, one of the bottom teams in the SEC, not taking anything away from Gage, but it allows you to be a lot more aggressive, right? Those guys, you know, it's like, all right, cool, we got a 4 or 5 run lead, challenge you. Like, I'm going to throw the ball, I'm going to throw heaters, I'm going to throw strikes. If you hit a solo home run, I'm just not going to walk guys, I'm not going to be too fine with things, I'm not going to put people on base unnecessarily. So it kind of allows you to be a lot more aggressive and open up that strike zone where you don't have to be so fine and worry about one base runner or two base runners, right? And just kind of be, you know, more aggressive and just going right at guys. So I always appreciated it. You know, obviously when your team's winning, there's a lot better energy in the dugout. You're trying to get your guys back up because they're obviously seeing the ball well and putting runs on the board. So, yeah, it's definitely a completely different mindset.
As good as game one was, game two saw some problems all year long, rear their ugly head yet again. Missouri got 7 two-out runs in game two. Just couldn't get off the field, and that was one of those things. And Luke Holman couldn't get off the field, just gave up some hits, and they had runners on base. The floodgates opened, and that's just that's been a problem all year long, and it showed itself again. Game two, LSU loses 8-7.
No, absolutely. I was thinking we might have a comeback there at the end, you know, and somehow salvage that game. But you said it. I mean, and it's been, you know, it feels like we're beating a dead drum or whatever that saying is or whatever.
Dead horse?
What's the saying? Dead horse. That's what I was going for. Thank you, Jordy. It's Monday. But it seems like that's what we talked about all year, right? I said, you know, good teams kind of put teams away when they get two outs, you know, and good teams also, you know, hit with two outs. And that's where I think the difference is this year. Abby and I were talking about it on our show yesterday. We're kind of middle in the pack for most of our stats, but it's those little separators that I think are causing us to be, you know, at the bottom of the SEC record-wise. And, when you can't put guys away and you can't finish innings, that's always going to kind of come back and bite you eventually, right? So we definitely saw that, you know, tip of the cap to Missouri. But you know, that's what Luke struggled with. And I think you saw it. There was a couple times or maybe in the second or third inning, you know, Nate came out and talked to Luke with two outs and you could just tell that he was emphasizing that kind of stuff. Hey, this is a big part of the game. And it's something that they've struggled with. And obviously there's definitely some emphasis on it, but we've talked about it all year, like where they go back to the drawing board on Mondays and that's the little things in the team meetings that you're focusing on, right? Getting those two outs or that final third out, and then when you have two strikes, putting guys away. So, it definitely came back to bite them. And unfortunately, it happened to Luke Holman, who's been our ace all year, who happened to pitch on Saturday.
Well, I always equate it to other sports. In basketball, if you're not shooting well from outside, there's an easy fix to it. You drive the ball to the basket, you either get a layup or you get fouled and you go to the free throw line. So what do you do? For the series, LSU Pictures gave up 8 total two out runs. So as a pitcher, how do you break that curse? What do you do?
It's honestly, I think it's more focus, right? I think there's, and especially, you know, just talking from experience, when you get 2 quick outs or you get 2 outs, you almost want to put your guard down. You're like, all right, cool, got those 2 outs. That's huge. I just got to get 1 more, right? It's more of a mindset thing. So for me, those are the little details that I think the pitching coach has to really emphasize. And again, speaking from experience and things when I played, some of the greatest coaches, it was more their mindset that taught me the most, right? Hey, when you get 2 outs, get that 3rd out. It's actually the most important out. You know, we talk about getting the first strike and advantage counts and things like that. But when you get that 2nd out, it's really about getting that 3rd out and closing out the inning and things like that, right? So it's a mindset, and it's something that's got to be kind of ingrained in the pitching staff as a whole, and it's got to be something that you guys focus on each and every bullpen, each and every game. And when you do it well, you got to celebrate it, and you got to focus on it, and you got to focus on the positives, right? But when you don't do it well, it's something that's got to be a main focus throughout the week and meetings and things like that. So I don't know what Nate's doing, you know, behind closed doors, but I think that's got to be something that they've got to be talking about. If they want to go to the postseason, if they want to play in the postseason and win in the postseason, those are the things that they got to be able to do, is close out innings and close out batters when you get 2 strikes and 2 outs.
He's Anthony Renato. We're talking LSU baseball. As good as Gage Jump was on Friday, Griffin Herring was sensational on Sunday, coming out of the bullpen through 5 scoreless innings, allowed 1 run, 1 walk, struck out 8. That's bullpen. That's mastery.
Absolutely. Yeah, and you don't see it, you know, 5 innings out of the bullpen, but when you get a guy pitching the complete game on Friday night, you know, and eating up all those 7 innings, we talked about what it takes to be an ace, right, and why Lou Coleman was that ace and what you want out of your Friday night guy, and that's kind of it, and that's the reason. You know, and obviously when you 10 run them and you only have to pitch 7 innings, you know, granted, LSU did go to the bullpen with 7 or 8 arms or something on Saturday, but you were able to salvage Herring, who's been kind of that stalwart, that one arm out of the bullpen that has been our go-to guy. So when you have a 2-0 lead in the 4th inning or something like that, you turn the ball over to him, and he obviously has proven that he can give you length and be able to do those things.
Yeah.
And he had pretty electric stuff, and to be able to punch out, I think, 8, he had a career high, right, in those 5 innings or something like that.
That's right.
The dude absolutely looked great. Yeah, it was awesome.
As much as we talk pictures, we got to talk about one kid. I don't think they planned on this, but through trials and tribulation and a lineup that struggled with clutch hitting early in the season, this freshman, Ashton Larson, seems to be the guy. He's leading the team in batting average during SEC play. He went 3-for-3 in the opener Friday, increased his average to .419. He finished the weekend 5-for-9 with 2 ribbies and 4 runs scored. Who is this kid?
I love it. We were talking about it on our show yesterday at Modesto. I mean, it's always one of my favorite things, seeing a freshman that comes out of nowhere, you know, and obviously has earned this starting spot, and he's flourishing. You know, I think he's batting like over .375, .380, something like that, whatever it is now. But the dude is absolutely awesome. I love him. He's obviously played some really solid right field as well. He's got a really sweet swing. It's simple, compact to the ball. And the ball is jumping off his bat. And you know, sometimes when you're a freshman and you come in, you have this success, right? You have this crazy confidence. You kind of heard that in the post-game interview yesterday.
Yeah.
Obviously, he's from that area, you know, and he had a bunch of family members and things like that. But the kid is confident. He wasn't cocky. I thought he did a great job in his interview. So he seems like a really likable kid, and the things that he's doing on the field are absolutely great. So it's nice to, you know, obviously we won a series right now. I'm trying to be positive. But before this weekend, he was kind of that bright spot on our team when things were kind of dark. So I've really enjoyed watching him play, and I'm excited for the rest of his career now that he's kind of started off this way and obviously is a pretty solid ball player.
Like he's here to stay. LSU back on the diamond tomorrow against Nichols. And then it's a Friday, Saturday, Sunday versus Auburn at the box. When you look at the standings, LSU really made a little bit of ground, didn't pass anybody, but they're now 1 game behind Ole Miss, 2 games behind Alabama. Auburn at home, they're a team that's only won 2 games. They're 2-16. So This is the series you got to sweep. I mean, there's no ifs, ands, buts about it.
No. Yeah, this is definitely a sweep series. You need it. If you're going to try to, you know, make a regional, and obviously the first step is getting to Hoover and not finishing in those bottom two spots, this has to be a sweep to put you in a position, because you obviously, you know, you have Texas A&M coming in the box the following weekend, who's number one in the country, and that's going to be a tough series. So this weekend has to be a sweep to put you in a position where you can hopefully, you know, have some breathing room and things like that. So Auburn seems like they're rebuilding, you know, seems like it's not a great team. But, you know, baseball is a funny game, so you can't take them for granted. But LSU needs to pack the box, and all the fans need to come out and be in good spirits. But it's one of those things that if they do sweep, right, again, I'm the optimist. I'm an LSU fan. I'm an alumni. I want LSU to be great. It's a nice storyline saying LSU has won 5 out of 6 in SEC play, taking on the number one team at Alex Box, right? So it's one of those things that it is possible, and there could be a nice little storyline and momentum building into, you know, Texas A&M coming into the box. So not looking past this weekend, but like you said, I think this there's definitely an eye on a sweep if there ever has been, right, especially this year.
If there ever – exactly. One quick one before we get out of here. How soon does Paul Skeens get called up to the bigs? I mean, I know they're taking their time with him, a few innings here, but nobody's hitting him in Triple-A ball. Nobody.
Jordy, it's a good thing that I stopped betting for a little while, because if I was still a betting man, I would have lost a lot of money on when he was getting called up. I said to everybody, you know, I was like, he should be their opening day starter. I really don't understand. I know some of their front office people are, you know, they were actually with the Red Sox when I was there, and they are kind of notoriously known for taking their time developing pitchers and stuff. But what is there to develop when you're dominating like this, and he has dominated everywhere he's gone, right? I think you promote him and you challenge him and let him learn the lessons in the big leagues against the best players and best hitters in the world, right? The Pirates are obviously in the hunt, right? They're in the mix, right, and one of the better teams in the Central. They have some really good players. So I have no idea, Jordy. I couldn't tell you.
I know he's a starting pitcher. But how about him coming out of the bullpen just to start his career? You're not going to pitch him many innings. Let him come out and throw an inning in the ninth and close, and just throw those heaters like he does. I mean, that'd be crazy.
I know. And if they do make the playoffs, that's where I see him playing, because they're obviously going to have a pitch. And maybe that's why they're only pitching him 3 or 4 innings in the minor leagues, is because they see themselves potentially being in a playoff race and they want him to have a certain amount of innings available and stuff. I think out of the bullpen would be awesome. Like, we get to see him throw 103 every single pitch.
Every single time.
But, yeah, it's absolutely electric. The kid's a stud, so I don't understand. And then I don't know if you saw on social media, but he stayed like an hour after the game signing autographs for everybody. The line was all the way up to the concourse. The kid's a stud. Like, he just gets it.
My daughters think he's great. They say he's got to shave the mustache. That little snidely whiplash thing's got to go. But anyway, whatever
the mustache
works.
Thing's got to go in culture anyway. These kids, they love the mustache and the mullet. And I'm like, man, I feel like this is one of those errors we're going to look back on and be like, what is actually happening? But again, I don't know. Maybe I just missed the boat and I'm too old now, but I don't know.
Same here. Anyway, Anthony, you're the best. We'll talk to you next Monday after a break the brooms out. Sweet. I hope.
Let's go. Yes, Jordy. All thank right, you, man. I appreciate you always having me all on. Right, you're man. The man.
All right. Anthony Renato, kind enough to join us. We'll switch gears. Pelicans had one in their grasp, and down the stretch, they couldn't hold on. Ali Cassell joins me next.
Go sign up for our rewards club at ESPNSouthwestLouisiana.com so you can score tickets, gift certificates, and much more. This is ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
All right, we're back. Heartbreaker last night. Pels with a chance to take a steal one on the road, come up short, and they lose to the Oklahoma City Thunder. The Thunder take a 1-game-to-zip lead in the best of 7 series. They had plenty of chances to take the lead in the final 2 minutes. 4 of them in a 28-second span with the game tied at 90, and they just could not knock one down. Ali Cassell, my main man. Let's talk some hoops, Ali. How are you, buddy?
I'm doing well. And I'll tell you what, I'm actually encouraged. When you watch the previous 7 playoff games, the first-round playoff series games, Jordy, they were all lopsided, right? The Pelicans, wire to wire, were right in this one. They had a chance to win it. And Yes, the 5 minutes, I know we're going to get to it, but boy, if they just make some shots earlier in the game, right? If anybody gets any kind of rhythm, I don't think it comes down to that, and they win.
Well, the game changes completely in the playoffs. You can mug somebody and get away with it. It's just how the officials let things go now. But on a positive side, Pelicans beat them up inside, 18 offensive rebounds, turning into 24 second-chance points. This is a Jonas type of series because, the big stretch guy can't handle him physically.
Yeah, that's the Pelicans' best mismatch on the floor, and congrats to the coaching staff for recognizing it, because you noticed immediately the game plan was to go inside the JV, to let him work on against Chet Holmgren, especially if he was one-on-one. Then they started sending some doubles here and there, and of course you pass out of those. And of course the Pelicans got open shots, but boy, they missed them all. But you're right, I think that's going to be the theme in this series. I hope they actually go to JV even more so. And you have to wonder, in that last 5 minutes, I know Larry Nance had kind of a nice run there. That's when the Pelicans seized the lead by 2 points at 82-80. Larry was involved in that. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I think instead of Larry, JV's in that game, say, the last two and a half minutes, I guarantee he probably changes the tide. At least the Pelicans would have had, I think it was 4 turnovers and a couple of blocks against them and 6 possessions straight. That's just ugly offense.
Yeah. Late game situations, 3 of 11 from the field, 4 turnovers in the final 5 minutes. And it's amazing the game ended up being as close as it was. So Pels played some defense, but, they've got the one weapon that the Pels don't have. And that's Shai Gilgeous-Alexander, who can get a shot on his own. I don't care who's playing against him, what kind of defense you throw up. He's going to get a good look at the basket. And 5 out of 10 times, he's going to make it.
Yeah, look, I mean, there's no surprise why he's been nominated as one of the finalists for the Clutch Award this year, right? One of three. Yeah. So he's been doing it, right, for the last couple of years. He knows exactly how to get a shot and or just set somebody up, right, one of the teammates, right? That's where Brandon really struggled with the physicality against Lu Dort. Shai somehow is able to manipulate any kind of physicality, what defenses throw at him by, staying on balance at all times, but also knowing how to draw fouls. I thought that was the biggest key. Right, Brandon, right, he tried to back Lu Dort in late in that game, got called for an offensive foul, because you're right, he swung out his arm. But Shai doesn't do that, right? Instead, he just, like I said, knows how to draw contact and get the personal foul on the defender. And that's something that you wish one of these Pelicans would have, right? Zion uses it basically bully ball, and sometimes he gets called, sometimes he doesn't. But really, there's nobody else that can consistently to the free throw line. I think that's just huge, right, in the playoffs, especially when you got to go one-on-one. Your best player's got to get a score. I just wish B.I. had it. He'll throw some ball fakes, right, but nothing consistent like Shai. And so, yeah, it's not a surprise. I mean, Shai wasn't perfect. I do want to point that out. He had some bad turnovers, I felt like, in that fourth quarter, throwing it to nobody. And that was during that stretch where if the Pelicans could have just gotten a couple buckets, right, Jordy, I think they win that game because their defense was honestly that spectacular.
It was a good look by McCollum. He got that rookie Cason Wallace to bite on the pump. And he had a leaping leaner from three, but he was squared up and he just hit the rim and all that stuff. I just don't like in this type of scenario when you can hold and grab and push and shove. I just wish the Pels would move the ball more, get it from side to side, get it inside, kick it outside rather than posting up and backing Ingram in. And, I just don't like that type of an offense. So when you analyze this is, they don't play again till Wednesday. So there's going to be a lot of film study and there's going to be a lot of adjustments made for game two by the Pelicans since they didn't win. Normally the team that does win keeps the status quo. So what do you think Willie Green and this staff is drawing up to change some things to try and get one on the road?
They've got to find something that just works in the last 5 minutes. Now, granted, I thought they had some good shots. I mean, there was this one possession where I think the Pels shot 3 open three-pointers, missed them all. Brandon's was kind of bad, the last one of the bunch, but still. You just got to think they're going to make some more open shots. But either way, you have to know what you're doing during the last few minutes to where, okay, you feel like your odds of scoring are good. right? Whether that's getting CJ going to the rim, B.I. somehow, getting JV where he's really sealing off his man down low after the ball's moved a few times. Like, I don't know, Jordy. I thought the ball movement was actually pretty on point. They missed a slew during the first three and a half quarters. They missed a slew of wide open threes that normally they go down at a regular pace. The Pelicans would have gotten to about 110 points in that game, but they didn't. Yeah. So you need to have a backup plan, right? Whatever that is, maybe. I hope that they can identify something, find some mismatch on the way Oklahoma's guarding, right? If Lou Dort's going to be that much up on Brandon, that means he's not going to be helping off. So maybe have somebody, maybe having a couple screeners like in Spain pick and roll to where you know he's not going to leave B.I. for one of them. So maybe somebody rolling's going to get open. Because I saw Trey, he actually did some of those either ghost screens and he, for whatever reason, OKC kept on leaving him open. So I guarantee you they're going to find something. It's really just going to come down to you just got to make your fair shots. I know OKC didn't make them either, but that's why you end up with 94 and 92. It's good defense, but you got to make something. You got to maybe get to the free throw line. And best, the worst of all, I think, they got outscored in the paint. I know that second chance points were great, rebounding was great, but when you get outscored, I think it was 42-36 points in the paint, and that's your bread and butter, even though you don't have Zion. Right. That's got to change too.
Boy, if I told you Oklahoma City went without a field goal for 5 minutes and 14 seconds of the fourth quarter, I would say the Pels did what no other team did in game one of all the NBA series, and that was to steal a win on the road, but they didn't. I've always believed if you're being guarded as tightly as Dort was on Brandon Ingram, you have to use Ingram as a screener. He's got to be a screener first, and then you try and get some kind of a switch up on that. And then if you don't, then that's going to free up a Trey Murphy, and nobody's shooting it better than he is. So that's what I would do offensively. I'd use Ingram as a screener first and then try to get him the ball when there's a switch or some type of a mismatch that way. But to have him back down, back pounded and pounded and pounded, and then end up shooting a fadeaway jumper, man, that's your odds are just not that good for that.
No, and guess who's the best at doing that? The Warriors, right? How closely teams over the years have had to guard Klay Thompson, Steph Curry. And what were they actually best at, though? Setting those kind of screens, right? That's how either they get open or they'll get somebody else open. And so I couldn't agree with you more. I would love to see B.I. getting involved in some kind of screens involving C.J. or Trey, right? Because they're all three good shooters. They're all three good scorers. Somebody's going to get open if you just throw those man movements out there. Somebody's going to get open. But I'm telling you, I don't know how this physicality can keep going like this, Jordy. I mean, there was this one point where Jose sets a great screen on Lou Dort, and Lou Dort flat out grabbed him, threw him down to contest Najee's shot. I couldn't believe it wasn't foul. Yeah. I get it that you're allowed to be physical, but there were some things that, you know, it went a little bit too far. I thought B.I., there was two hands on him often, right, to where they called some bumps. But you know what? I watched the other playoff games, and it wasn't – that much contact wasn't allowed. So I'm very curious how they're going to actually call game two. If they call it where they're going to call some of these fouls a little more often, then I think that actually plays in the Pels' favor. But I think they do a good job of defending, right? Say, without fouling. They just kind of drape around them, show him arms, length. As to where the Thunder, they flat out were pushing, shoving. Same thing happened to Jonas too several times. So I'm very curious if the referees take some advisement, maybe catch a little heat from the office. About they got to call things a little tight, because otherwise I could see a fight result, right? When you're throwing Jose Alvarado down, I guarantee he's not going to take that for very long.
Right. I'm with you. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask for an update on Zion and his situation.
Yeah, I wish I could say that he's back to even just doing 3-on-3, but he's not there yet. And unfortunately, he's just going to be doing his rehab work still. So that's the positive for me. If he can keep stretching, building up strength, and really it's going to come to this next upcoming MRI. If he shows significant healing to where that tear is pretty much healed up, they're probably going to let him go. And so we're probably about close to 7 days away from that. If that's the case, and hopefully I don't think his conditioning could get that out of whack, especially since I've heard he's been doing the bikes. He's trying to stay on top of things. He could maybe still bounce back into the series. And, boy, would that be something. Right, say maybe for game six, if it goes that far, Zion comes back, you're playing at home, and then you push it to 7. I think that'd be fantastic.
Ali Cassell, you are fantastic. You're the best. We got to wait a couple days. I tell you, I could find some better cities to have 2 days off than Oklahoma City, but what the heck? They're there on business. Let's take care of business Wednesday night. Thank you, my friend.
Absolutely. And good point. No more Las Vegas for me, at least this season.
That's right. Ali Cassell, our NBA and Pelicans insider, joining us. Just to give you an update, it was a Pelicans trail by 10. They fought back, took a 90-88 lead on a Brandon Ingram steal that led to a layup. But here's their next five possessions after the layup. Offensive foul on Herb Jones. A turnover after a rebound by Larry Nance, who threw the ball to Trey Murphy, but Murphy was standing out of bounds. The third possession, a missed dunk by Nance. The fourth possession, a charging call on Ingram. And then the worst possession of the game, the Pelicans grabbed three offensive rebounds and failed to score after each of them, with the possession ending with Nance throwing up kind of a finger roll that Chet Holmgren blocked. And then the Thunder took a 92-90 lead that they would not relinquish. So in the stretch, in the clutch, Pelicans fall short. Back to wrap up our number one next.
Helping you get through your workday. This is ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
All right, we're back to wrap up our number one. Let's do our poll question again. Give everybody a chance on the Pels. Can they win the series after dropping game one when they had it right in the clutches? Make one bucket. Don't have one less turnover, and you get the win. Now it's a best of six. Pels have to win four, and Oklahoma City only has to win three. So what's the vote tabulation to date?
Right now, 44% of the votes are saying yes, they can still turn this series around. 34% have said no. 21.5%, 22% said only if Zion plays. We did get a couple of comments, one of them being Ton. He said they can still win, but they're going to have to play flawlessly through the full game rather than half or three-fourths of it.
Okay. Well, we'll see what happens down the road. Is there anybody hotter in the world than Scottie Scheffler? Just a week ago yesterday, the Masters green jacket, and then he goes to the RBC Heritage. I guess he's like, you know what? My wife hasn't had a baby yet. I'm hot. Let me go try it again. And sure enough, he had a 3 under 68 on Sunday for a three-shot victory there, and he just keeps on winning and winning and winning. And I have the stat here. Let's see. Oh my gosh, where did I put it? He's just been incredible with what he has won of late. So many championships. I think he's won five of the last six and came in second place in another one. He's won, I mean, just, okay, Harry, he's finished, he earned $3.2 million. So that brings his season total to $18.7 million in just 10 tournaments. The good news for the PGA Tour is he won't show up again until the PGA Championship the third week in May. He's headed back home to Dallas. They're expecting their first child sometime next week. He's on the proverbial heater. Yes, indeed. Scottie Scheffler. Hour number two, straight ahead.
This is ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
That's right. Can you dig it?
It's time for 2 hours of the best sports talk on the airwaves.
Can you dig it?
The Jordy Holtberg Show with your host, the Blonde Bomber himself.
Can you dig it?
Jordy Holtberg.
Hour number two of two, and away we go on this Monday, April 22nd, one day after the Pels drop game one of their best of seven series to the Oklahoma City Thunder. Game two coming up on Wednesday, a day after LSU gets a 2-1 series win over Missouri, and just a couple of days away from the NFL draft. My man James Mesh back in the EFCO Development Studios. In the producer's chair, he's on the campus of Delta Media, where you'll find ESPN 1037 Lafayette Head West. We're on ESPN 1041 in Lake Charles, streaming all over the world thanks to our free mobile app, ESPN Southwest Louisiana.com. Saints.com. Everybody in their right mind says Saints need offensive line help, and that's where they're going to go in the first round. I want to know what they're going to do in the second round. And with that in mind, let's go to our expert as the Saints lead writer, reporter for at Saints News. He's with Boot Crew Media. He's everywhere. My main man, John Hendricks, kind enough to join us from his own secluded war room as he tries to figure out what the Saints are going to do, because they need to strike gold with a couple of these picks that can come in and play right away and be impactful players for this Saints team to get a little bit better. John, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. How about yourself, sir?
I'm great. Was I accurate in that assessment about offensive linemen, and they better strike gold in this draft or could be troublesome?
Yeah, I thought you were referring to the war room at first. I was like, yeah, I kind of have an office to set up, but, you know, but for real, though. I think they do. And I think the offensive line is the unanimous pick. I don't think there's any denying that for anybody that was confused or thinking that. And, of course, it's going to depend on how the board falls. I think they're in a situation where you don't have to be aggressive this year. You don't have to sit there and say, okay, we're going to have to trade up to get this particular prospect, because when you're going to pick at 14, you should have several very good picks available to you if you're addressing this offensive line position. Now, we're going to talk to Mickey Loomis at some point this week, and I would expect to get some type of update on Ryan Ramczyk. And so I think if that's something to pay attention to, because, you know, that could help alleviate a few things, but I still think even if it is a good prognosis, they've got to look at addressing this position, because this is not something that's going to continue to get better for Ramczyk. It's only going to get worse. And so that's a definite thing that they got to look at. But, you know, look, I think once you address the offensive line, you can look towards 45. I think a defensive tackle makes sense. I think a tight end makes sense. I think a wide receiver makes sense. And so I think that would probably be where my head's at, and where I'd look at picking right off now.
Let me ask you this, John. New offensive coordinator, new way of doing some things. There'll be a lot of offensive linemen available. What type of offensive lineman do you think this San Francisco coordinator coming to New Orleans wants? Does he want the guy that's the big, bulky, run blocker? Does he want the total package? I mean, you'd love the total package, obviously, but what kind of style of player do you think? Because there'll be a bunch of them available, I believe.
Yeah, look, here's what I would say, because I've seen a lot of people talk about Olu Fashanu, and that's probably been the most popular pick. And look, I think he's going to have a great career. Here's my thought process on this, that A, they haven't given up on Trevor Penning. He's going to play left tackle, so I think that's really where they're going to look at putting him. So I don't think that you draft a guy like Fashanu and then just say, okay, well, let's move Penning to right tackle offhand. Now, that's what I'm thinking at the moment. Now, when you look at what you need somebody that's going to be able to adapt in this wide zone scheme. Obviously play action is going to be big, pass blocking is going to be big, but you want somebody that has the last athleticism to get out in space. And so I think that they would look at a true right tackle is where I would look at in the draft. I like J.C. Latham. I know he's had some penalty problems and some effort issues, but I think he's my favorite guy. If not, a guy like Fuaga or Fautanu makes sense for me, and as far as where you pin in. But look, I don't think that they're in a space where you say, oh, we have to go get a Joe Alt. But they're in a spot where when you look at the athleticism with blocking, I think they're going to have a good bit of choices on their hands, but that's kind of where I would lean, is somebody who's going to be able to come in and is somewhat familiar with the scheme, if you will. And then even if they're not, I don't think that's a bad thing, but that would be a bonus if they are.
Do the Saints need to trade down in this draft? I mean, if there's going to be so many there, because they have a first rounder, they have a second rounder, they don't have a third, they don't have a fourth, and they got a ton of fifth round draft picks. Would they consider trading back and getting another second rounder or a third rounder? Or what do you think?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely not their MO, but again, you'd never say never with this team. And, you know, I think it's going to be fascinating if somebody does come and say, look, we want to move up a spot or two and potentially get into this, you know, get your pick, and then the Saints are going to make out with a better haul. So if that does present itself, then I think that's the situation where you say, okay, maybe we can trade down a spot or two, still get our guy that we're thinking, and then be able to recoup maybe a third-round pick or even just get a fourth-round pick. I definitely would be in favor of something like that. But, you know, of course, it depends on how the board falls. That's obviously number one. And then it's going to depend on, you know, if the Saints can be a little bit restrained here and wait a little and to see how things unfold, because the draft madness is real. And for New Orleans, I think that, you know, you're not going to see them use all those fifth-round picks. It's just not going to happen. They're not going to use all those base three picks. So they're going to get in the third and the fourth. I think they could dip into next year if they really wanted to get there without having to trade up or trade down. But, you know, of course, it all remains to be seen. But I think when you look at it they just got to get this thing right, because there are so many things that this team does need in some aspects that, you know, you just look at it and say, okay, well, I think that, you know, there's a lot of arguments to be made for different positions. And I think defensively, with the exception of defensive tackle, I think they're pretty set in a lot of ways. I think some of the day three guys with the new special teams, that'll be where a lot of those will come in and really be interesting to see how they shape up.
Just from a history perspective, since 2008, the Saints have executed 25 draft day trades. Each of them has been moving up in the pecking order, not back. The last time they traded back was 2007. They swapped second round picks with the Detroit Lions and picked up a fifth rounder in the process. So if history is anything, Saints won't trade down for sure. I'm really curious. You mentioned defensive lineman, you mentioned tight end, you mentioned wide receiver as a possibility with the second round pick. And again, so much depends upon how the board shapes up and snaps up. Out of those three positions groups, where the Saints are picking in the second round, which one do you think has the highest quality where they can find a guy that they can count on and rely upon day one?
Well, I think this is a very rich wide receiver class. I think that's what I'd say for starters. And so I think offensive tackle and wide receiver are probably some of the biggest areas. Now, of course, in day two, when you're looking at defensive tackle, I think there are some question marks when you get into day three. You know, a guy like Tavondre Sweat is probably one of my favorites. And, of course, I've seen him as a second, a third, or a fourth-round pick right now just because of some of the issues that have happened off the field, and he didn't have a good RAS score. But, you know, again, I think that when you look at it, this team still needs a possession receiver. They still got to figure out that void left behind Michael Thomas. They got to find their next guy, and I don't think they really have it, even with some of the additions that have been brought on the roster. Yeah, I think there's some good ones, but I don't think that's the plan at this moment, as you're saying, that a guy like Cedric Wilson, with all due respect, or Equanimeous St. Brown are the guys that you say are going to be your possession number one guys in this offense. Mm-hmm. But, of course, it remains to be seen. But I think they can get considerable value on day three with wide receivers. I'm interested to see if they go for a shiny toy like a Malachi Corley from Western Kentucky. He's been kind of the Debo Samuel of this draft, if you will. And so I think there's a variety of ways they can address this thing. It's just, how are they going to do it, and where are they going to be smart about this thing?
From the people that I value, by all accounts, this draft is top-heavy, and it lacks real quality depth. Apparently, 20 players carry first-round grades, and then the talent drops off precipitously after the third and fourth round. So it's really not the greatest of drafts to have four fifth-round picks. How do the Saints – what do you think is doable to package to move up into that third round somehow, some way? What do you think? I mean, you got to get – you got to offer, and you got to get convince somebody to take that offer. What do you think is doable?
Yeah, look, I'm actually writing about that, you know, what it would take to get in the third or fourth, because, of course, player movement is a possibility, but I think that you look at some of the recent trades from last year that, you know, you can trade some of the picks next year to get into the third, it doesn't cost you as much as some of the people might think. And so I think that, you know, some of the examples that we saw last year, you know, whether it's a fourth and next year's draft can get you up or you know, whatever the case may be, I think it's going to just be fascinating to find out where the Saints do actually go, because I just don't think the cost is an exorbitant amount, but you're right. On day three, you can get some depth and role players. And if this team is having to rely on a fifth or sixth or seventh rounder to be that guy in their team to start and such, then they're doing it wrong and they don't have the right guys to begin with, is probably what I would say too. But, I think there's a case you can get a wide receiver on day three. I think that's something you could potentially wait on and potentially get that at that point. But, you know, it's just something that they can trade. They can be active to get to that pick if they do choose so.
If you can't deal that one, and I know Saints fans would probably hate this, but do you trade pick 45 and get two third-round picks, or is that taboo?
I don't know if it's taboo. If somebody says, let me trade up a few spots and then we'll give you our third, then I'm all for that. Something, you know, at least I'm listening to that. You know, I don't know if the Saints are going to say, well, I think that's just too good to be true. Or, you know, you get a lot of people that are desperate. And I remember the Saints, when they traded for Adam Trautman, they gave up a pretty good king's ransom of picks just to get into the third round. And so I think there are some cases to be made where a team that's really valuing somebody and they see him available, they're going to go up and get him. And you know, I don't think it'll be a great, like, even if they get a third or fourth round pick, I don't know if it's going to be a fantastic pick, you know, like one of the, or even a future pick. I don't know if it's going to be something that you look at, but again, it's just worth paying attention because you just don't know how each team sees each prospect. And then some people just can't sit on their hands and wait for them to fall, that they feel like this team's going to go out in front and get this particular prospect that you like, and you just got to pull the trigger. And if New Orleans isn't a person that you feel like you can get that done with, then I think you would see that throughout the draft.
He is the best in the business, John Hendricks. How many quarterbacks do you think get taken in this first round?
I mean, the over is definitely on five. I think it's definitely at least five or more. That's going to bode well for the Saints, actually. I think that's what makes it so good about getting an offensive tackle, is that there's going to be so many quarterbacks taken within the first 10 picks that when they get to 14, they are going to have their pick of the litter. And so it's really going to be on them. They got to get this right. They can't go with a small prospect. They can't go with, you know, the guy who just didn't hold up, even though he's got the good score. You got to go with somebody who's been proven, who you can coach, who can plug in immediately, because as of right now, Ryan Ramczyk is not in the equation. So I'm feeling that right tackle need, and yes, it might be a little bit of pain with a rookie, but I think at the end of the day, it's definitely going to be worth it.
It is really, for the Saints, when you really look at it, big picture, may not be the sexiest draft, but for a position that they are in such dire need of, thank goodness teams need quarterbacks. Thank goodness there are three high-level wide receivers. There'll be seven or eight players offensively at least taken very early in this draft. And so, like you said, the Saints will have an opportunity to get somebody, and it just depends on who they fall in love with. We'll see along those lines. Jaden Daniels, you got him going number two overall? Chicago's not drafting him, are they?
No, I don't think so. I think the teams to keep an eye on. I really, from everything I've heard, the Raiders are the team to keep an eye on when it comes to Jaden Daniels. I think that's where the spot would be for him. Vikings are pretty interesting, but, you know, I think that it just depends on, you know, this is an evaluation where you're saying, okay, we need our franchise quarterback, and I really love Jaden Daniels. I think that he's going to be able to turn a franchise around. It's just that, you know, are you going to be able to get them when you need to? And you just always see those teams that come out of the woodwork and get this haul. And at the Commanders, can they jump up some to get them? Because as of right now, they're at 13. Do they make the big old splash trade or not? But I think that, you know, Daniels is a guy to keep an eye out for Vikings or Raiders, and how they get there, I don't know. But I think that's where you got to look at for him.
Well, that's That's the drama in all of it. Chicago's already laid their hand out, it seems. Washington's, everything's close to the vest, so they must be taking some phone calls, and we'll see what happens. But LSU could have, seriously, they could have three players drafted in the top 10. I think there's a chance.
Yeah, there's always a chance. I mean, I like Brian Thomas, and obviously you look at Jaden Daniels, really? And then Neighbors. I mean, it is possible. I think there are reasons to be made. There's a lot to love about these LSU guys. And LSU has a really good factory of wide receivers that they've produced over the years. I mean, it's just, you can't really go wrong when you do something like that. And so I think that depending on a team that's going to really need it, the Chargers are a team that probably needs a receiver and something to look out
Buffalo.
For.
Buffalo.
There are just so many different ones. Buffalo's got to have one, too, because of trading Stephon Diggs. And so there's going to be all sorts of surprises and twists and turns in this draft, which is always so much fun. But, you know, those are some teams you got to just keep an eye out.
The Saints won't be sexy, but they'll be efficient, and they'll get what they need. Now, hopefully it's the right one that can step in and come and play right away. That would be terrific. John Hendricks, thank you, my friend. I know you've got some what are your draft leading up to the draft day plans with all that you've got going on?
Well, I mean, you know, it's going to be one of those that's where it's like, okay, we've got to – I've got to have a live show tonight. We're going to worry about picking out some mock stuff tonight. And so I'm looking forward to that with Ross. And then we got to look at, the middle of the week, we're going to get to talk to Mickey at some point. And then when draft day rolls around, it's going to be crazy hectic. And I'll be at the facility every single day on Thursday and Friday and Saturday all day. And then the real fun gets going after for the undrafted pool. So it doesn't stop. It only is going to get busier from here on out. So tomorrow might be the low point or lull in my week, and I'm going to enjoy it for sure.
Do the Saints take care of you guys out there at the facility? Feed y'all and that kind of fun stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. And we get some food out there, so we're good. And
well, you'll have to do
– set up with some you'll have to and grade, all that good stuff.
You'll have to grade the food because the players say it stinks.
Well, they cater stuff, so it's not like we're going to the cafeteria and all that stuff is going under renovation right now, so I don't know if you can even get some of that stuff right now.
All right. John Hendricks, thank you, my friend. Get some rest. It's going to be a long week, but you love it. You live for it, and let's see what the Saints come up with. Thank you, buddy.
All right. Thank you.
John Hendricks, kind enough to join us. Take a quick time out here. We'll come back, and we'll discuss some other stuff. Still to come, Blake Ruffino later on. How's LSU doing in the transfer portal? Saints need offensive linemen. Tigers need defensive linemen. We'll get the latest after these messages.
Go check out our YouTube channel at ESPN_SWLA for the latest episodes of Miguez Mindset, Over Par, and so much more. That's ESPN Southwest Louisiana Sports Station on YouTube.
We welcome you back at 24 minutes after the hour. Will Wade promised that he'd keep this thing rolling on the men's basketball side of things for McNeese. He signed 6'3 guard Sincere Harker from the St. Louis Billikens, a junior from Rockford, Illinois. Averaged 16 points, 4 rebounds a game last year for the Billikens out of the Atlantic 10 Conference. Shot 49% from the field, 43% behind the arc. And, of course, he joined 6'9 Joe Charles from the Raging Cajuns, formerly of the Raging Cajuns. As additions to the McNeese roster, more are expected to come your way. More changes are coming. FBS games will look different next season with the NCAA approving 3 significant changes. We talked about the helmet communication. Now they also approve the use of sideline tablets and the 2-minute warning. The NBA announced the finalists for its 7 season-long individual awards yesterday. Nikola Jokic, the favorite to win his 3rd MVP. Victor Wembanyama, the heavy favorite to win Rookie of the Year and the Defensive Player of the Year. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander is a finalist for 2 awards, the MVP and the Clutch Player of the Year. They're going to give the MVP to Jokic They're going to give the clutch player of the year to SGA. The Jets are trading former number two pick Zach Wilson to the Broncos, where he hopes for a fresh start in Denver's got some brand new unis and all that kind of stuff. Major League Baseball had a big Saturday. They drew 540,363 fans across 16 games Saturday, making it the highest attended non-opening week April day in 8 years. Yeah. Shohei Ohtani hit his 176th Major League Baseball home run on Sunday, passing Hideki Matsui for the most by a Japanese-born player. What were you doing when you were 15 years old, guys and girls? Well, Miles Russell made 7 birdies in a 10-hole stretch Sunday to become the youngest player to finish in the top 25 at a PGA Tour of Korn Ferry Tour event. 15 years old, 7 birdies in 10 holes. And if you like long baseball games, you should have been in Texas, because Midland and Odessa started playing a high school basketball, a baseball game on Friday. 25 hours and 23 innings later, Midland won 4-3 in the longest game in Texas history. How about them apples? And in the golfing world, no, I don't know if we've seen a streak like this where men and women have dominated professional golf, but never seen two do so simultaneously like Scottie Scheffler and Nellie Korda are right now. Scheffler followed up his Masters win by winning the RBC Heritage today. It's his 4th win in 5 starts, and he finished runner-up in the other one. Korda won her 5th consecutive start yesterday, emerging victorious at the Chevron Championship, the first major of the season. So in their last 5 starts, Scheffler is 76 under par with a 67.6 scoring average, and Korda is 61 under par with a 68.6 scoring average. This is the second time in history that the reigning top-ranked men's and women's players won majors in consecutive weeks. Tiger Woods and Lorena Ochoa first did it back in 2007. And Korda is just the 3rd LPGA Tour player to win 5 straight starts, joining Nancy Lopez in 1978, Annika Sorenstam in 2004, 2005. Only 3 PGA Tour players have done that. 5 straight starts. Byron Nelson, Ben Hogan, and Tiger Woods did it not once, not twice, but 3 times. When he gets hot, he can't be stopped. Plain and simple. So Scheffler earned $16 million in prize money over the last 44 days. His caddy, Ted Scott, has earned more money this season, $1.78 million, than Rory McIlroy has won, $1.71 million. Ted Scott going, man, I picked the right dude. I picked the right dude. All right. Finally, tonight on the hardwood, Orlando and Cleveland, with Cleveland with a 1-game-to-zip lead. The 76ers are at the Knicks. The Knicks also held serve at Madison Square Garden. And it's game 2, the Lakers and the Denver Nuggets, with Denver leading that series 1-game-to-zip. We'll take a timeout here. When we come back, Blake Ruffino will join us. The transfer portal. It's quiet. What's LSU doing? We'll find out next.
You're listening to ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station and your home for the LSU Tigers.
All right, it's Monday, which means it's time to bring in our good friend from the Are You Serious podcast, the one and only Mr. Blake Ruffino. Blake, good afternoon, buddy. How are you?
Good evening, Jordy. How are you?
I am terrific. saw where Arch Manning threw for 300 and something yards and three touchdowns, including a 75-yard bomb on his very first play. That's a pretty good quarterback room over there with the Hook'em Horns.
Yeah, and they got a couple of the third-string quarterback threw for 290. So, I mean, they are pretty deep in that area. Delta kid, more than anything, Jordy looked bigger, you know, physically yeah. bigger. I don't think that anybody ever questioned his IQ or his decision-making. I think that, you know, Jordy, at least for me, when I saw him play at Newman, we got to see him play seven times in person. It just he needed to be get physically stronger. And you can tell he's probably about 222, 225, and he looks a lot better than – I mean, clearly, he's just maturing. So, looks a lot yeah. better now that we've seen him through this spring.
All right, let's talk about the portal. I saw where Indiana transfer defensive lineman Philip Bleidi, whatever, was on LSU's radar, and he's committed to Auburn. So –
Yep.
What are you hearing on, you know, we talk about the NFL draft and the Saints need offensive linemen. We talk about LSU football. They need defensive linemen.
Yep. So Simeon Barrow, the Michigan State defensive tackle, is on campus currently. He'll be here through Tuesday. So I do think that is an avenue along with him and C.J. West from Kent State is the two guys that they will target within the next 2 weeks. And try to get committed. I also think that Dominic Williams from TCU is someone that they're trying to get in and will get in on around April the 30th. So, Jordy, I think that they have come into three guys that they really like and are going to close in on. I also don't think that it's over with when it comes to defensive tackles for LSU. Specifically, I don't think that all the guys have completely hit the portal yet. With that being said, some teams, like we just saw with Texas and others, and other teams not in the conference, are now post-spring. And it'll probably take a couple days for some guys to hit the portal. I do expect more defensive linemen to come out. As we've seen, Jordan, more defensive tackles have come out in this portal period than any other position group in the country, almost combined, mm-hmm. when you get down to it, because of the need for them on some of these bigger schools. So, we'll see how this progresses. They're on Simeon Barrow, who I think, as of right now, is the best interior defensive tackle that has entered. He is currently on campus. I have heard some good things about that visit.
Is that the big guy from Michigan State?
That is the big guy from Michigan State. If you're going to call a spade, was arguably their best player last year.
Yes.
And I don't think it's remotely close. So it would be like, for them, Jordy, it'd be like Will Campbell hitting the portal.
Okay. Gosh. You know, I'm always curious about this, you know, because in high school, they get their eyes on kids when they're sophomores and they start recruiting. They can get them signed up as a junior and all. I wonder what this portal thing, because it's almost like LSU's in a state of desperation because they need bodies. I wonder how they determine who fits them the best in such a short period of time.
Well, specifically, and look, so we can use this under Brian Kelly specifically, okay? But the bottom line has been, Jordy, you live by the portal, you die by the portal, right? And you've hit on them.
Yeah.
And what you've really hit on, and what teams have really, really hit on, is experienced 4- and 5th-year players that are really good college players. Right? Let me give an example. Mm-hmm. Florida State. Jordy, they do get some high-talented guys from the portal. I'm not saying that they don't. Who are the guys that they have gotten defensively? Well, what they have done is they've gotten 3-, 4-, 5-year guys that come in and play, like Braden Fisk, et cetera, in the interior of that defensive line, where they might not be the overall best player in the country or at their position, but they know what they need to do. Jordy, the truth is that more coaches would rather, from conversations that I've had with them, they would rather get the experienced guy and maybe 1 and 2 guys that quite honestly have shown that they can play for an in-house season. So you think about like Dominic McKinley and then going into the portal and getting interior defensive tackles. So look, that's, they're going to have to hit on at least two. And look, LSU, Jordy, for what it's worth, is that's not the only position that they're going after. I know that Brian Kelly said 2 weeks ago that it's the only position that they're going off after. Well, you offered a running back, you offered a receiver. So the bottom line becomes, I don't think that LSU has ever done, ever, recruiting the portal if they think that they can add somebody. So the teams that have had the most success have gotten experienced players from the portal, and that has been how, I mean, Jordy, you can even look at LSU to some extent. I mean, Paul Skeens had, what was it, 72 games under his belt before he transferred here? So it's just so much experience that you gain that you can't replicate.
I know experience matters, but sometimes, you know, like you said, it's you live by it, you die by it. And LSU's died by it, especially in the defensive secondary. They had some guys that we thought, oh, these are going to be great, and they just – personality-wise, character-wise, it just didn't fit at all.
Yeah, and you were hoping because, you know, you had a lot of people pushing for Denver Harris because of the LSU connection. But, Jordy, like I've said, I said the entire time with that young man, with all due respect, Jimbo was literally on his last leg and let him walk.
Uh-huh.
What does that say?
Oh, yeah. Right? Exactly.
You know, and we thought because, you know, it's stepdad playing here, whatever, oh, well, it'll be different here with the culture. And it wasn't. Again, you live by the portal and you die by the portal. And I thought that Saban said it best. Listen, we've dabbled in the portal. We got corners at the portal. Okay, five-star guys from the portal. Eli Ricks is who he's really talking about. That didn't pan out, but they're so talented. Jordy, Eli Ricks started six games last year for the Eagles.
I know.
Right?
And so
you look at just like, who would you rather, Denver Harris or Jerick Bernard Converse? Well, Jerick Bernard Converse, yeah, he got beat some, but he also picked off Bryce Young in the back of the end zone. There's just some things I think that you can't teach. Now, Jordy, I will tell you, if there's ever guys like Jerick Bernard Converse in the portal, You got to go after him. And I do think that Simeon Barrow is one of those guys, a glue guy, and Jordy is going to be electric. I mean, the kid literally had, you know, not so talented human beings around him and made, you know what, a chicken salad, if you get my drift. So,
Jaden Daniels is the best portal player LSU's Burrow. Daniel, and I guess the third one would have to be Wingo, I would think.
I'm just trying to think. But obviously your audience, I would put Jerick Bernard Converse ahead of him, if I'm being honest.
Really?
Just because of what, because of what Jerick Bernard Converse meant. Jordy was the highest rated DB that Brian Kelly's had at LSU by a long shot. He had four interceptions in the season that was completely unnoticed. And basically, Jordy, he had the pass breakup that sent the game into overtime, okay, against Alabama, and he had the pick that gave you the hope that you can go down there and then score and be with him. Wingo, while he's up there, I mean, Jordy missed nine games this season.
I know.
You know what I mean? Games this season. That's tough.
But his first year when he came over, he was pretty good.
He was really good.
He was pretty darn good. I'm with you.
Not a lot of people are going to agree with me on that. I just think that Jordy, here's the truth. Jerick Bernard Converse saved your secondary.
Well, he got lost in the worst defense, one of the worst defenses in LSU history. He got lost in that.
Yep.
You can't say. You know, I know it takes all 11, and he was good, but all the other ones were terrible. So, anyway, we'll see. Who gets just terrible. So, who's going to be next? In 2019, LSU won a national championship in football. In 21, LSU men's outdoor track and field. In 22, the LSU dance team. In 23, we had two championships, women's basketball and baseball. And this year we've had two title winners, LSU dance again. And how about the women's gymnastics team? How do you like to have to win a championship on the toughest apparatus in the sport, the balance beam? And they came out like champions and won the darn thing. That is spectacular.
Unreal. I mean, look, you know what makes that story more surreal than anything is that Jay Clark not celebrating until DD got on the platform.
Yep.
You know,
classy move. Classy move.
You know, when you get that close to to being the best, so many times for it finally to come to fruition, it's got to feel ultimately satisfying. You know, and so look, I hear that there are a lot of schools coming after Jay Clark now. So Scott's got some maneuvering he's got to do, but what a heck of a performance. Look, Jordan, she won't be because, you know, a lot of people don't understand her greatness, but Haley Bryant's got to be in the top 10 LSU athletes maybe we've seen.
No question. I remember when I was at LSU, when we would go into the Carl Maddox Fieldhouse. They had that indoor track, and we would do conditioning drills in that facility, run around the track and do, we got time for all these races. And over there in the little corner is where gymnastics would practice. And there was Dee Dee coaching. She was young. She was coaching them up. And to see then to where they are now. And it was a classy move by Jay Clark to do that. No question about it. I don't think Jay Clark's going anywhere. I think they'll pay him. I think he's got the best facilities.
I agree.
And most of these girls are coming back. They're coming back. It's like basketball. They're coming back. They'll be a favorite. Now, whether they do it or not, time will tell. I guess everybody wants to know, when's the next LSU football national championship coming? And your guess is as good as mine. I don't know.
Yeah, I'm just going to keep it real, Jordy. I'm not there with this team. I'm on the borderline if they can make the playoff, to be real with you. Now, I will tell you, if they do get hit on some of these interior defensive linemen, I do worry about their secondary. However, when you're better up front, that goes a long way. Do think, Jordy, I think they're going to be more controlled run the football than Brian Kelly is admitting, because I think they're going to have to. But here's the thing that I talked to somebody last night about this. It's, you know, around football ops. I do think that, Jordy, they're gonna get more creative in play calling. And I think there were some young guys this spring that showed up that I don't think that this staff is going to just sit on their hands and not pull. I would not be surprised if you start seeing some of these young guys that Brian Kelly recruited and hit on that you don't start hearing in August, like Kylan Jackson, Deshaun McBride, and others. You start saying, hey, where did this kid come from? I do think that those two safeties are going to make a big difference for you this upcoming August.
Okay. I hope so. We shall see. You're the best in the business. He does it daily, sometimes twice a day, just depending upon what's going on. But he's the host of the Are You Serious podcast. Does an outstanding job. Blake, thank you. Mondays are great with you. We'll talk to you next week, buddy.
Thanks. Go Tigers. Good morning. Thank you.
There you go. We'll take a final timeout. We'll come back, wrap this bad boy up. How did they come up with the 24-second clock in the NBA? I'll explain next.
The biggest headlines in the world of sports are discussed here. ESPN 1037 Lafayette and 1041 Lake Charles, Southwest Louisiana's sports station.
All right, we are back. 54 minutes after the hour, a couple of minutes before we wrap this up. James Mesh, final poll results of the day, sir, dealing with the Pelicans versus the Thunder.
Yep, 44% of the votes said that they think the Pelicans still can win the series despite losing a prime opportunity in Game 1 on the road. 35%, however, have said no shot. Last 21% said that they can, but it depends on if Zion plays.
Okay, well, I still I don't see Zion playing. We shall see what goes along those lines. Our thanks today to our guest list, Anthony Renato, talking LSU baseball, Ali Cassell on the Pels in the NBA, John Hendricks, the upcoming NFL draft, and the Saints and Blake Ruffino, all things LSU. Tomorrow, we have scheduled Jay Clark, the national champion victorious coach from LSU Gymnastics, and the program's one and only coach prior to Jay Clark, Dede Bro. We'll talk a lot of gymnastics tomorrow, what it means in the present, what it means for the future. So we'll deal with that and looking forward to that, plus much, much more all the way around. It was on this day, April 22nd, the year 1876. The Boston Red Caps beat the Philadelphia Athletics 6-5 in the first official National League baseball game. And April 22nd, 1954, the NBA adopted the 24-second shot clock, ushering in the modern era of pro basketball. So the question is, why? How did they come up with 24 seconds? And this was a brainstorm of former Syracuse Nationals, now the 76ers owner, Danny Biasone, who championed the change. He said, "I looked at the box scores from the games I enjoyed, games where they didn't screw around and stall. I noticed each team took about 60 shots. So that meant 120 shots per game. So I took 2,880 seconds, which is 48 minutes, divided that by 120 shots. The result was 24 seconds per shot." Did you know that? I didn't, but that's how they came up with the 24-second shot clock. How about them apples? The NHL's coming to Salt Lake City. Utah will have two teams in the four major sports, leaving just two states with one Big Four team. That's baseball, basketball, football, and hockey. Those two states happen to be Oregon, who just has the Trailblazers, and Oklahoma, which just has the Thunder. James Mesh, thank you for all you do. Thanks to all of you for listening in. Thanks to our partners that make it possible each and every day. Until tomorrow, I'm Jordy Helfrich. Stay thirsty, my friends. Do everything you can to stay healthy. Let's be kind to one another. By all means, be happy. AFR is next. Enjoy the rest of this gorgeous Monday. So long, everybody.